Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and welcome to an adventure in history. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Seaside Hospital here this evening with Mac Burns, the director of Clatsop County Historical Society.
But now you have to give your title too.
Community Partnership Liaison.
Oh, that's right. That's how come you don't give yours, because yours is too long.
It is. It's a fun one, though.
You should have like one of those long business cards.
It is long. So yes. At one point, there were hyphens.
Oh, no.
Because I had multiple roles. So this is actually the consolidated version.
Excellent.
There we go.
Consolidation.
Yeah.
So we had a great guest last week.
We did, yes. Lori from Seaside Downtown Development Association.
Learned all about Seaside.
Yep. We love it. We love South County, North County.
And I'm glad because I didn't know the origin story of these stars.
Yeah. Yeah, that was...
And I honestly kind of thought that was probably something that had been around since like the 20s.
Late 90s. What year did they start? Was it 96, 97?
Yeah, I think somewhere in that range.
Yeah, that's great. They've done great things. So,
see, if it predates my arrival here on the coast, then I think it must have been 100 years ago.
Right. Well...
It's hard for me to picture, like, oh, that just happened a year before I got here.
Yes. we do have some things happening at the Historical Society.
We do.
It's still an exhibit.
A temporary exhibit that, that you have less than... Just a little more than 3 weeks, because it leaves May 25th.
Yeah, and this is the closest it's getting, folks. So if you want to see this exhibit, this is your chance. Unless you're going to go to Boise, Idaho in a year.
In a year, or down to Los Angeles in a year and a half.
Yeah. I'll take here instead. So tell us a little bit about
it. And a little bit cheaper, too.
Well, for sure.
It's the Away From Home, Native American Boarding School Stories. Mm-hmm. And it's a very powerful subject. This is a traveling exhibit put together by the Mid-America Arts Alliance and the Heard Museum in Arizona, world class, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. And it's on the road. It's booked for the next 5 years. We've had it. We opened April 6th, and it's going to leave here and go to Pennsylvania. May 25th is the last day.
I love it. And I always like to bring up activities to do with your kids. This is an activity that you can do with your children. However... The caveat is...
They do not recommend it for elementary school kids, right. But as we had a conversation about a month ago with the curator of the Historical Society here, Chelsea Vaughn, you got to know your kid and decide, because it is a kick in the gut. I mean, there are a number of just moments where you kind of get sick hearing this story and just think, wow, we did this to other people.
Because this is about children.
This is children,
little ones. I mean, the pictures are children. The stories are about children.
Yeah, and this was a deliberate attempt by the federal government to destroy Native American culture.
Right.
And you do that by taking the kids and making them change their clothes and change their names and change their religion and change their looks and not let them speak their language, and you really treat them kind of badly.
So certainly your middle schooler, high schooler, I think that these are good stories to tell our children. Because they do need to hear it and feel it and have those emotions as well. And it's important to recognize that they too can be respected for learning about this.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a powerful exhibit. Highly encourage it. And, you know, if you're a member, you get in for free. And if you're not a member, what's wrong with you? But if you're not a member, it's just $5 for adults and $2 for kids.
Right.
So dirt cheap.
There you go.
So
great.
It's at the Heritage Museum upstairs in the Parker Gallery.
All right.
Okay, shall we get to it? Because we got a lot of stuff.
We do.
So this day in history, this is stuff for tomorrow, May 3rd, 1469, the Italian philosopher and writer Machiavelli is born.
Ooh, okay.
1802, you're kind of a political science person.
We'll see.
So Machiavelli, you probably know about him.
Yeah.
1802, Washington, D.C. is incorporated as a city.
Oh.
But not a state.
Not a state. Oh, don't they feel it.
Don't they feel it. 1921, the first state sales tax. And I never in a million years or 50 guesses would have guessed which state. Well, I guess I would have guessed it in 50.
Right. I never guessed.
But
get
probably
this right.
About 48 or 49th. West Virginia.
Okay.
Is the first state with sales tax.
Interesting. That does surprise me.
And honestly, you know, for a state trying to raise money, that's a pretty good one, because you're not taxing your tax base. You're citizens. So if you're the governor or the state legislator or whatever, so he's, let's stick it to the foreign, foreign states coming in here, the travelers, we'll get them to pay our taxes.
That's good. Yeah.
So West Virginia is the first one to think of it. 1933, the godfather of soul, James Brown, is born.
Oh, I like that.
I'm not going to try and sing anything. 1940, but you could if you want.
No, thanks.
1942, the Battle of the Coral Sea begins in World War II. 1971, All Things Considered premieres on 112 national public radio stations.
Oh.
I like All Things Considered.
Yeah, that is a good one.
But do they really consider all things?
Well, and how does it compare to An Adventure in History?
Well, hands down, we know that we're a better show, don't we?
Well, of course. all things considered, I would say so.
We're the best show ever.
Yeah.
Although, you know, that's been taken out of context, because when we started saying that, it was that this current show is going to be our best show ever.
That's true.
And then people started misquoting it and saying it's the best show ever. But see, I was like, we're
people
amateurs.
People like us, people.
And, that's right.
People.
And it's really that amateurs like us. This is our best effort yet.
That's true. Yes. And everyone gets better, right?
That's right.
Yes.
All right. But our history highlight of the day. And sometimes these are not fun things.
Right.
The thing I think had the most impact, 1980, MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, the founder's daughter is killed by a drunk driver. 13-year-old Carrie Leitner in California is her daughter, and she starts MAD after this. Because she got MAD.
Well, yeah.
As she should. So not you know, something good at least came out of it, that we're going to start talking about drunk driving and
yes,
and fight it. But this is the day that her daughter, 13-year-old daughter, got hit by a drunk driver.
Yes.
So I think history highlight of the day. Did I miss anything?
That is the highlight for sure. 1984, though, Coach John Thompson of Georgetown University becomes the first African-American coach to win an NCAA basketball tournament.
Wow, good for him.
Yeah, I like that. We always like to, I like to throw in the sports ones, too.
You do.
Because you like to overlook those.
I do. I fully admit
that
I frequently overlook the sports ones.
Yeah.
Okay, but and something else I overlooked.
Yes.
This exhibit about the Native American boarding schools, there was something in there about code talkers. And I think probably almost everybody listening knows about World War II, frequently Navajo, but there were some other tribes that were used. They were used as code talkers because the Japanese couldn't understand the language.
Hmm. Yeah.
And you just send one guy on one end of the radio and the other guy and just hand them the message to read, and they could communicate. And apparently the Japanese had a heck of a time and just could never figure out the language and figure out what was being said. And I was familiar with that story.
Mm-hmm.
But in this exhibit, there's actually a guy who was a code talker in World War I.
Okay.
And I was not familiar with that. So being the good historian that I am and the inquisitive person that I am, I had to look up some more information.
Okay.
And now I've teased everybody, and they think we're probably going to talk about World War I code talkers.
Yes.
But we're not. That'll be another show, perhaps.
The segue here.
But that I learned as I was going through and looking up these guys, I realized there's a lot about World War I that has impacted us today.
Okay.
In our society.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought maybe that would be fun to kind of review these. So I've actually taken them from a few sources, but this is really by a person named Kellen Perry.
Sure.
So these are the ways that World War I has impacted the way we live now. So also known as the Great War, World War I was a world conflict that lasted for roughly 4 years, 1914 through 1918. You know a bit about World War I from history class, the assassination of the Archduke. You call it the war to end all wars. The Allied powers versus Central powers, trench warfare, Europe changed forever, millions upon millions of lives lost. But do you really know how World War I changed the world?
Dun, dun, dun. The impacts of World War I on the world are far-reaching and immeasurable. This list merely covers some of the most significant and obvious ways that it changed the world. First and foremost, it changed warfare forever, and along the way, ushered in countless technological advances that we still use today. It was an event that straddled times of great advancement, something that was documented both with modern film, photography, and traditional paintings. Some of these things were destined to be developed anyway, but one of the ways World War I changed the world was by greatly hastening these developments. Necessity is, as they say, the mother of invention.
Okay, so the first one, it forever changed how wars were fought. It was in World War I that technology became an essential element in the art of war. Submarines, aerial bombardment, armored tanks, toxic gas attacks, barbed wire, all were either invented or revolutionized during the Great War. It was also the first time technology was such an overwhelmingly destructive force, with poison gas alone capable of wiping out thousands at a time. The Germans even had so-called Blue Cross shells containing, and I'm not going to pronounce this right, so you chemist people out there, I'm sorry, diphenyl chloride, which made victims sneeze violently. That just sounds like something out of like a comedy novel or something.
But awful, nonetheless.
A Peter Sellers movie, maybe. They called these shells mask breakers.
So World War I also forever changed the public's attitude towards war. Historian Jay Winter argues that World War I discredited the concept of glory and exposed the idea that it was noble to perish for one's country as an old lie. Winter claims that the propaganda, literature, and painting of war was cleaned away by artists and poets following World War I because, quote, millions of men slaughtered deserved more than elevated prose. They deserved the unadulterated truth. End quote. Now, this truth comes to light in the nonsense verse of the Dada movement and in the nightmare paintings of the surrealists who denounced the obscenities of armed conflict. Winter also notes that soldiers writing popular memoirs helped expose the realities of World War I to millions back at home.
Code breaking during World War I led to the development of modern intelligence agencies. The British developed a knack for code breaking during World War I, particularly with encrypted German radio transmissions. These advancements later led to now famous intelligence gathering operations such as MI8, GCHQ, and the NSA in the U.S. The most famous bit of code breaking during World War I was the so-called Zimmermann telegram. We just talked about this like a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
The German foreign minister, Arthur Zimmermann, received an encrypted telegram describing plans to attack the U.S. shipping lanes to the U.K. The telegram also mentioned Germany's desire to ally with Mexico and have the Mexican army attack U.S. territory. This decoded telegram led the U.S. to declare war on Germany in April 1917 and Mexico to say, hey, we never considered that.
Right, yeah. Scientists also started to better understand PTSD. Post-traumatic stress disorder wasn't formally recognized until 1980, but during and after World War I, doctors began to understand and diagnose the psychological impacts of conflict in a new way, which laid the groundwork for our modern understanding. During World War I, some medics thought the physical impact of explosions caused the war neurosis so many soldiers were experiencing, also known as shell shock. We now better understand, thanks largely to the efforts of doctors and scientists during World War I, that the emotional stressors of war are to blame for the symptoms shown by thousands of soldiers coming home from the battlefield. Because so many World War I era soldiers, 80,000 British soldiers by one estimate, were experiencing these symptoms in the safe confines of their homes, scientists and doctors began looking for answers.
You know, I'm glad that we recognize that because I can't even imagine being shot at or shooting at people and being in that battlefield situation in any of the history that, that I've read. So I'm glad that medical science and the larger society has realized that this stuff is traumatic.
Oh, for sure.
World War I made the United States an economic powerhouse. Prior to the war, the U.S. was primarily a debtor country. That changed with World War I. The turnaround was dramatic. The U.S. emerged from the Great War as net creditors to the tune of $6.4 billion. Back when it was big, B. This later led to New York being considered the de facto financial capital of the world, a spot previously held by London. World War I taught the federal government how to play an important positive role in the economy, a lesson it put to good use in the Great Depression.
Always something positive. World War I saved BP and helped usher in the age of oil. Before World War I, British Petroleum, BP, was also known as Anglo-Persian Oil Company at the time. The company wasn't very successful. In fact, if it wasn't for Winston Churchill's decision to build faster warships that ran on oil instead of coal, BP may have gone bankrupt. Instead, the oil industry flourished, thanks largely to the World War I effort. Oil became incredibly important to keeping the newly mechanized style of warfare going, and protecting oil supplies became a huge part of the strategy of warfare, just as it is today.
So before people are like, Winston Churchill, wait, are you talking about World War II suddenly? Winston Churchill was actually in the Navy Department back in World War I. So,
wow, made the big decisions yeah. too.
So modern surgery was born in World War I. Okay. Surgery as we know it was born during the war. Fighting in the trenches led to many soldiers needing reconstructive facial surgery using skin grafts. So-called broken faces even had a union to support them. And I'm not going to try and pronounce this, but it's a long kind of French-looking word,
yes.
series of words. It's the association of the wounded to the face and the head. Advances made while working on the broken faces led to later revolutions in the fields of oral, maxillofacial, and plastic surgery.
Yeah.
Who would have guessed?
Yeah.
Do you want me to do this one? We didn't like plan which one of us is going to do this, each
you
one.
You do this so, one, and I'll do the next one.
So World War I popularized condoms.
There we go.
At least in the UK. Now, I hope story time is over and all the kids are in bed. or else, you got some explaining to do, Lucy. A few of the many common ailments suffered by World War I soldiers were STDs. Mm. As many as 5% of British soldiers suffered from venereal diseases, and the U.S. Army discharged more than 10,000 men because of STDs. Men often visited local brothels to try to escape the horrors of battle. The UK decided to do something about it in 1917 and began issuing condoms to troops. Historian A.J. P. Taylor credits this with making condoms popular in the UK. The U.S. was not quite as proactive. They issued a prophylactic kit meant to treat certain STDs after contraction. It wasn't until World War II that the U.S. distributed condoms to soldiers.
Kotex sanitary napkins were invented by Red Cross nurses during World War I. American company Kimberly-Clark developed a super-absorptive cotton alternative called CelluCotton in 1914. Now, once the U.S. entered World War I in 1917, Kimberly-Clark increased production of the material for use as surgical dressing on the front line. Red Cross nurses working on the battlefields recognized another use for it, as maxi pads. When World War I ended, Kimberly-Clark repurchased the surplus from the military and started producing Kotex sanitary towels in 1920. I love those Red Cross nurses.
I kind of love everything about that story.
Yes.
I love that they're using it for the good of soldiers on the battlefields. And then they realize, oh, there's something even amazing here.
And a company could keep going.
And then they buy the surplus back and start this great company. Yeah. I love that.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Wireless technology developed rapidly during World War I. Modern smartphones and wireless handsets owe a lot to the technological innovations developed during World War I. Transmitter and receiver technology improved significantly during the conflict and required far less power than before. Using wireless sets to triangulate signals and locate enemy radios was another major innovation. Wireless didn't necessarily mean portable, however. In 1916, wireless communications sets for airplanes weighed 300 pounds.
Wow.
And could you fit that in your pocket?
No. That wasn't going to work. Pilates was invented inside a war internment camp. The wildly popular 21st century exercise routine known as Pilates was developed during World War I. The man behind the fitness craze known as Pilates, German boxer and bodybuilder, Joseph Hubertus Pilates developed his method while in a British internment camp during the war. Joseph Pilates used springs and straps from the beds to do basic resistance-based training, which he later developed into the spring-based equipment he used in Pilates today. After World War I, Joseph Pilates returned to Germany for a few years and further developed his exercise regimen before moving to New York in 1925 and opening up his first body contrology studio with his wife, Clara.
There's so many words in that I love. I love his name.
Yes.
Joseph Hubertus Pilates. And I love the body contrology studio.
Yeah.
Is that a gym?
Yeah, 1925.
World War I added many words and phrases to the English language. World War I either spawned or popularized dozens of English words and phrases still widely used today. Cooties. I had no idea it was a new term for lice.
I didn't either.
I thought it was just a thing little kids did on the playground, that you got cooties. Which makes it even meaner now that I realize it's about lice.
For sure.
I feel so badly because, you know, I mean, I said some kids had cooties and they said it to me. So, all right, chow for food, to scrounge, to search and pilfer, and fed up to be disgusted with it all date from World War One, as well as the British phrase Great War. The Americans preferred World War. There's also cannon fodder, cushy, foxholes, zeroing in, and dud for an unexploded incendiary device.
Those are good words.
Those are all good words.
Yeah. Flamethrowers were developed during World War One. It marked the first time the modern flamethrower was used on the battlefield. The Germans used flamethrowers in more than 300 battles, flushing enemies out of trenches and burning them alive or scarring them for life. The Flammenwerfer design proved so effective that the British and the French also started using them. Their use was limited, however. The fuel only lasted about 2 minutes, and the weapon's range was limited to 20 yards.
You know, that doesn't seem very far away if you're in the middle of a battle.
Yeah.
I kind of want the guys to be further away from me.
Well, for sure, yeah.
Aircraft carriers were developed during World War One. During World War One, British Squadron Commander Edwin Dunning was the first person to ever land a plane on a moving ship, an aircraft carrier. He landed on the HMS Furious, a 786-foot-long battle cruiser, on August 2, 1917. Dunning was also successful in a second landing on the Furious 5 days later, but his engine choked on his third attempt, and his plane crashed off the starboard bow, killing him.
Oh.
You know, that's sometimes where 2 out of 3 ain't good enough for
me.
No. The Furious was also used in World War II before being sold for scrap in 1948.
Oh my gosh, they used it again?
That doesn't seem quite right.
No. Artificial nitrates used as explosive in World War One are still used today in agriculture. The Germans developed artificial nitrates to create explosives shortly before World War One because their natural nitrate source, Chilean guano deposits, was in short supply. This innovation was lethal during the war, but now helps to sustain one-third of the Earth's population as ammonia nitrate fertilizer. Converting atmospheric nitrogen into ammonia essentially out of thin air using only high pressure and high temperatures prolonged the conflict for years. This process, slightly tweaked, also happens to make an excellent fertilizer. Fritz Haber, the German chemist who developed this process, won the Nobel Prize in 1918 as a result. Haber is also considered the father of chemical warfare for his pioneering work in weaponizing gas.
You know, you did good, and then you did some not so good.
Right, yeah. Did you think they wondered about the Nobel Peace Prize?
Yeah.
Nobel Prize, excuse me.
Doctors began to connect vitamin D with sunlight during the war. The winter of 1918 was a rough time for children in Berlin. Due to undernourishment brought on by the impact of the war, half of the kids in Berlin had rickets, a disease that makes bones soft and deformed. Kurt Holjinski, a doctor in the city, performed some experiments and made the connection between ultraviolet light and the strengthening of bones. Scientists later discovered that vitamin D is used by the body to build up bones with calcium, a process triggered by ultraviolet light from the sun or from certain lamps.
Oh, but don't we always prefer the sun? Blue surgical scrubs were developed during World War One. Have you ever wondered why surgeons almost always wear blue scrubs?
I have.
Well, the idea was the brainchild of French physician René Lariche during World War One. Lariche had the idea to differentiate aseptic clothes and sheets from potentially bacteria-ridden items while volunteering with the French army in August 1914. The idea caught on, and surgeons today still sport the blue scrubs, although green scrubs also became a thing in the 1960s.
What does Providence use?
That's a good question. I think they're blue.
All right, and then the final thing, soy sausages were invented during the war to fight starvation. Mm-hmm. Vegetarians have World War One and the creeping effects of starvation to thank for soy sausages. The mayor of Cologne, Germany, I never would have guessed this starts in Cologne, Germany, and later the first German chancellor after World War II, Konrad Adenauer, made sausages out of soy to prevent the residents of his city from starving during the British blockade of Germany. He called it Freudenswurst, or peace sausage. Oddly enough, Adenauer couldn't get the soy sausage patented in Germany because it was meatless. Britain, however, granted him a patent in 1918.
Well, the Germans also were like, really? This is terrible. Yeah. Have you had our sausage
before?
Because this does not hold.
There's not enough ketchup in the world.
No, nothing.
So, you know, I'm always amazed that World War One kind of gets forgotten a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And there were so many horrible things that happened. And as we've just learned, so many things that still impact us today.
Yeah. Yeah, that was those were interesting lists, for sure.
So I have to give a quick commercial.
Okay.
There's a song called The Green Fields of France that you should like Google or look up on iTunes or wherever you find your music. It was sang in a camp summer camp that I worked in by three Irish guys. Mm-hmm. And it's about World War I. It's just very, very moving. So okay. I'm not going to attempt to sing it.
Oh, okay. What was the name of the song again?
The Green Fields of France.
Okay.
It's about a father walking through the cemetery looking for his son, who he knows is buried somewhere, and he stops by a grave of a guy named Willie McBride. Aww. And he talks about Willie McBride and the World War and, you know, did you die well or do you know why you died, that kind of thing.
Wow. Okay.
It's very moving, especially in a summer camp at the close of campfire with three Irish guys and harmonica.
Yeah. That one stayed with you.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. My gosh, from when I was 19. So, shall we take a little break?
That sounds good.
April 21st, 1897. New York novelty store. All kinds of books and stationery. Fine inks, pens, and pencils. Headquarters for all the leading periodicals in America. Sporting goods, fancy wear, baby carriages. Commercial Street, Astoria, Oregon.
And welcome back to An Adventure in History. We are continuing this Sunday evening. I do have to point out that today is my nephew's birthday. He turns 4.
And hopefully he's not listening to this horrific stuff about World Wars.
Well, no, not at this hour. He's long in bed.
But happy birthday.
Yes, I can tell his mom to look it up tomorrow on the podcast because you can find us on the podcast on KMUN.
And tell her to skip to the last 5 minutes.
Yes, happy birthday, Charlie.
So just a quick reminder, we do have this exhibit, Native American exhibit called Away From Home, Native American Boarding Schools at the Heritage Museum. It's here through May 25th, and we're open every day from 10 until 5.
So before we think about anything else, so I always like to talk about what to do tomorrow.
Yes.
If people were going to, let's say it's Charlie's birthday tomorrow, where could I take him in your museums?
At that age, I would recommend the Film Museum.
And tell me why the Film Museum right now is unique.
Well, we have limited hours.
And?
Or not limited hours, I'm sorry. We have limited attendance. We're letting three groups in at a time. They're traveling together. And because we're only letting those three groups in, there might be a little bit of a wait outside. But worst that it's been has been like 20 minutes, 25 minutes. And you got the place almost to yourself, it seems. So the hot sets where you can get to make your own movie, you can pretend to be driving a car and there's a green screen behind you.
Yes.
You're going to get plenty of time to make five movies up to about a minute each. And little kids, they may not know The Goonies. They may not know The Shining.
Right.
But they do know I'm on camera and I'm making a copy of this film.
I think
and there's something behind me on the green screen. So they have
perfect
a good time.
Experience to bring them. So what is a group size?
Do you know, under 7 or 8.
Okay.
So, and if there are three groups of 8 all in a row, we'll stop it at 1 or 2 groups.
Okay.
So it could be 3 couples and you're at 6 people and that's 3 different groups and you're done.
And you're not hurried through. You said that hasn't been a problem. Everyone is very understanding. So it makes just for a great, fun experience.
Yeah. I mean, I've said before COVID and pandemic concerns about social distancing, I've said for years, you know, if you visit on the Film Museum on a Saturday in July, it's crowded. And now, you know, it used to be if you visited on a Tuesday morning in February, you might have the place to yourself. And we've kind of created that with the limited groups, you kind of can be in the jail cells by yourself or you can be filming by yourself. So, or more importantly, you can be in the gift shop all by yourself.
Right. Yeah. What a great experience. I love that. So, I love that you've kind of fine-tuned that.
It's actually made the experience a lot better.
How fun. Great. Thank you. Thank you for that. And thank you all for listening tonight.
And happy birthday and go make some history. We'll catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.